Good morning. Welcome to this edition of the Richard Urban Show. We bring you news and views from the inpatient principal point of view. Very happy to have Stephen Wendland on. He's running for the U.S. House of Representatives in the 2nd Congressional District against Raleigh Moore. So, yeah, please introduce yourself.
First off, Richard, thank you for having me. And yes, I am the Democratic nominee for the 2nd Congressional District. As I campaign, I have found that there's a lot of people that don't quite understand what the 2nd Congressional District is. We redistricted back in 2020 due to a loss in population of census. We actually lost a congressional seat. So the 2nd Congressional District runs essentially from Harpers Ferry all the way to the Ohio River. It's both the eastern and the northern panhandle and a whole lot of counties in between. 27 counties to be specific, and it's 10,000 square miles.
Wow.
A lot of people also don't realize that gerrymandering, at least of congressional seats in West Virginia, is pretty much impossible. The West Virginia Constitution basically has three very basic rules. One, a county cannot be divided. Two, the counties in a district must be contiguous, which means they all have to touch. You can't have islands. And three, the populations have to be roughly equal. If only we could take what West Virginia has done and put it across the entire United States, gerrymandering, at least in the U.S. House, would be a thing of the past. So it is one of the things that I applaud the framers of the West Virginia Constitution. I think this was an amendment back in 1873, something like that. So, but that's your district. And it is a big district. It's one of the advantages that somebody, let's say, running from Northern Virginia has over us is that in, let's say, Northern Virginia, because of population density, a congressional district might be one county. We have 27, and I've already replaced a set of tires once on my vehicle.
Which county are you from?
Hardy County. I live down in Lost River, which is now, which is near Wardensville.
Okay, yeah, I've been there. I like the Trout River Recreation Area. Trout Pond.
Yeah, I live just outside of Trout Pond, and it is just stupid beautiful down there. It's why that will be my forever home down there, because I've never seen any place more beautiful than where I live.
It is. So what do you think the biggest issue facing our country is right now? That's a kind of broad question, but what's top of mind for you as you're running, for the U.S. House of Representatives? What's the biggest priority?
It's the political division in this country. I'm 58 years old, and I've never seen anything like this in my lifetime. And it's off the hook. We have Americans calling each other names and painting each other with these broad brushes of whether they are, Democrat or Republican, specifically MAGA, and just the yelling and just the discourse. And it's one of the reasons why I decided to run, is because this is not us. There are some artificial things that have been injected into politics lately that are dividing us. And I don't lie. I describe myself and have for years on Facebook as a rabid moderate. And I also don't think this is who we really are. I honestly believe that 80% of us can agree on 80% of the policies and the topics, and that the other 20% of those policies and topics, that same 80%, could probably find workable compromises. It's the 10% on either extreme who have a platform that's larger than their percentage should be. Mm-hmm. And so one of the things I ascribe to is, hey, let's take the microphones away from them, put them back in the car seats where they can't do any harm, and let the 80% of the adults get back to the business of running this country. Mm-hmm. And if we could just do that. And so, yes, I'm a Democrat, but I'm a rabid moderate, and I have no issues at all with Republicans or independents or anybody else. It's it's the overly loud people on both extreme ends.
Okay. All right. So on well, one topic you mentioned on your website that's near and dear to you is balancing the budget, if I'm not mistaken. Right?
Right, absolutely.
So I think that's a great idea on both sides aisle. That's obviously not being done. How would you go about that? Also, as far as the well, both sides, like I said, but how would you go about even beginning to do that when, like, for instance, we just had another continuing resolution for 3 months. How would you get out of that? It seems like we're so the House sent over seven bills, I'm pretty sure, for a lot of the appropriations, and the Senate never passed any of them. Presumably, that's the Democratic Senate majority, especially. So, how are you going to get by that logjam, and how are you going to buck your own party to get it done?
So first, let's go over some history. First of all, we have not passed a budget on time since 1997.
Wow.
Congress has one job per the Constitution. It's to fiscally run this country, and they don't do it. Yet, if you're an incumbent, you have a 90% chance of being reelected. So we've got to have to kind of look in the mirror on that one. We haven't balanced it since 2001, and this is insane. Instead, we get into all these sideshows where people get grandstanding and everything else, and it's the fear-mongering and the muckraking and all that stuff, rather than that just doing the business. What people need to understand is whenever they hear continuing resolution, you need to hear the word waste. Government shutdown, waste. Those things cost the taxpayers millions of dollars unnecessarily. So the first thing we need to do is we need to get back onto a normal cycle. And an omnibus isn't the way to do it either. Again, it's kicking the can down the road. So, quite frankly, there needs to be some rules in place. And such things as, you know what? You don't pass the budget on time. Guess what? Congress gets sequestered until it gets passed. Over in Anacostia, across from the Capitol, is a joint Air Force and Navy base. There's a barracks over there called Enterprise Hall. It's a horrible barracks. Our sailors shouldn't have to live there. I say, let's take it, rehab it. There's enough room for every member of Congress in there. And guess what? You're not going home until it's done. Also, hey, if that's your job and you're not doing your job, well, anywhere else in the world, your pay gets stopped. Okay? These are the
Okay.
types of things that we need to do if we're going to be serious about this.
Yeah.
And I don't think we're serious about it because we as an electorate do not hold our representatives accountable. And we need to start doing that.
You mean kick them out by elections or some what other accountability would
By
you want?
elections, I mean, we live in a democracy, of course, by
Right.
election.
Well, I
But
didn't mean a revolution, but I was just thinking. Of course, you call your congressman. I do. I call congressman.
yeah,
Tell him
and
what
I.
you think, but how much effect it has, I'm not sure. But
Well, and that's the thing. And we all have the ultimate say come November. And so the fact that people on both sides will just go straight ticket down their ballot and check it. I don't know what his approval rating was, but I will tell you, I have rarely have come across anybody that has ever spoke well of Alex Mooney, just basically because he's just not present. And yet he got reelected over and over and over again. So we need a better quality of candidate. And quite frankly, we need to be held accountable. One of the things that I plan on doing that I have control over is when I am elected, is I want complete transparency. You will be able to go onto the website and see my calendar. You'll be able to see who I'm meeting with, and there will be meeting notes for each of those calendar entries. So
okay.
if I'm meeting with somebody, you'll know. Because a lot of these guys, they spend all day either trying to fundraise or they're speaking with special interests. And that's not doing the people's business.
Okay. So we're talking about budgeting. Let's talk about a couple things. So there's been the large amounts of money given through whatever continuing resolutions, or I think sometimes they were extended resolution. I don't even know the technical name for Ukraine. 60 billion at a time. I don't know how much it's up to now. 200 billion, 300 billion. What's your opinion on funding the war in Ukraine?
Well, first of all, that's kind of a misnomer. When we are giving aid to Ukraine, what we're doing is we're giving them munitions out of our own stockpiles, and then the U.S. government pays U.S. manufacturers to replenish those stocks. So it is not like we're writing a check and handing, you know, sacks of cash to Ukraine. We're not.
But doesn't an X amount of money definitely go there? I mean, not all of it could go for just munitions.
Actually, the vast majority of it is. Or if it's medical aid or whatever. These are things that are taken out of U.S. stock, which, by the way, do have an expiration date on them. Well, 50 caliber rounds don't. They last a really long time. But pretty much everything else does. So all the missiles, all the medical aid, everything else that goes to them basically comes out of U.S. government inventory. And then we replenish it with brand new stuff, which provides for U.S. jobs and everything else.
But what about the overall idea of the conflict in Ukraine? And so, either way, we're funding it with a pretty large tune. Do you support it or are you against
absolutely it? Absolutely, I support it. Putin is a despot. And he will not stop. First, it was Crimea, and there was not, quite frankly, enough of a international backlash that he felt, and he was emboldened by that. And they went into Ukraine, and basically, he will not stop there. He will not stop. His goals are two things. One, he wants to reduce the United States to a third world country, and he laughs at us with this political division that we have where we're fighting each other. And two, okay, he's not going to stop at Ukraine because that's not what dictators do. And so the fact that we're in essentially a proxy war and we are not bleeding for this, that the Ukrainians are brave enough to face down this guy. By the way, you know, he's a former KGB agent, and to see the former president act like he's his BFF is just wrong. We need to, come on, people, just look at the facts here.
And there isn't a lot of, I mean.
So yes, I feel very strongly about the Ukraine.
Yeah, kind of what I would call saber rattling, saying, you know, next is going to, you know, attack Poland or something. I don't think that's accurate, but you think that's accurate?
I don't have a crystal ball. But I know that Ukraine is a democratic country, and this didn't become a thing until they started looking at joining the European Union. And so
I believe, if I understand correctly, was we said that wouldn't happen. But anyway,
well, it's not up to us. The European Union is between the European Union and.
Or NATO said it wouldn't originally.
Now NATO. So in NATO, there are requirements that have to be made. There are benchmarks there, and they were working towards those benchmarks prior to the war. How close they were, I don't know. But when this does get resolved, I suspect those benchmarks will be hit pretty quickly, and they will become a member of NATO if they survive this.
Okay. Well, on another. Okay, so that. That's clear about your skin on about that. Another, related kind of economic issue. Not kind of.
By the I never did answer your question about how are we going to balance the budget.
Oops. No. Yeah, that's a really good question. I mean, because what I was trying to say is a lot of it is just, I mean, that's maybe not the right term, political in the sense that, yes, I mean, if you just agreed, like you said, okay, we got to work together, we got to balance the budget. But it's kind of like, oh, the Republicans, okay, this is my opinion, obviously, but they sent over these bills. Hey, they're asked for this and that. Or we want to screw, whatever President Trump or whoever the current leader is. No, we're not, we're not passing that or whatever. You know, it's kind of like instead of really working toward it, you know?
Right.
And I mean,
So this is how we work towards it. There are two ways to balance a budget. You have to decrease spending and you have to increase revenue. Okay. By the way, none of us can run a household without balancing our budget. It doesn't last very long. The government needs to be held to the same standards. So first, decreasing spending. I spent 39 years in the United States Navy. All right. I've had joint tours and everything else. So I've been to include a tour in the Pentagon. I know how the budget process works in the DoD, or doesn't, as it were. There is so much waste in the Department of Defense. If we simply eliminated the waste, we would still have the strongest military in the world, capable of defeating any potential adversary, and be able to give that money back and basically fund all the other programs out there just based on the waste. Oh my God, there's so much waste.
I believe that.
All right. The other side of it is increasing revenue. All right. The tax code is overly complex. And because of it, it's loophole after loophole after loophole for those that can afford those loopholes. That needs to change. The tax code has to be greatly simplified, and people need to pay their fair share. The working class already pay their fair share. And so we're talking about, you know, the multi-millionaires.
You talk about like a flat tax and 10% or something?
Close. Yeah, I think that's worth looking at. And we need to address that. But I will tell you, the tax code is too complicated. It should be maybe 20 pages tops. And that would be revolutionary. So I don't call myself a conservative or progressive. I'm a reformer. And we have enough code on the books already. We need to go back in there and clean the code up that's existing. And then
what about, I'm sorry, like the idea of, I've thought about this. So I'm, you know, the age where I can take Social Security. And so what I'm trying to say is, what if you said something like 10% cut across the board, including entitlements? And as my wife already gets Social Security, and I could take it, I probably will in a few years, that I would support that. You know, yeah, I'll reduce my Social Security, whatever, but hey, everything else will be reduced. I would personally support that.
Yeah, the problem with reducing Social Security is this.
I'm saying 10% for everything, so people can't like pick and choose. You know what I mean?
I understand, but Social Security, we've paid into that. That's our money. And so saying that you're going to cut that, basically, if anything's done with Social Security, we need to remove the income cap off of it. So right now, I don't know what the cap is, but if you make over a certain amount of money, that money is no longer taxed, subject to the 6.5% Social Security tax. That needs to be removed.
What about the idea, though, of the my understanding is not that most of the spending is on the so-called autopilot stuff, like Social Security and Medicare and Medicaid. That's like something like two-thirds of spending. So if you don't cut that, how are you going to balance the budget?
So first, we need to go after the discretionary money. Until we fix that, we can't fix anything else. So we need to fix the tax code, and we need to fix discretionary spending. And then we can go after other things. But I will tell you, especially in West Virginia, that social safety net is so important to so many people. And so, again, until we can be responsible with the discretionary spending and cut the waste there, the mandatory programs we need.
Yeah, I hear you. I mean, we're not even anywhere close to that. But so when the Congress, since you've been looking into this a lot, when the Congress used to balance the budget, what has changed? When did it become? And now I know that both sides have been extremely inflationary, you know, Republican and Democrat, as far as increasing spending. What happened? Why do we apparently, well, from my understanding, this is not sustainable. It's not sustainable. But yet we're going down that path. What changed around 2000 or whatever, where we, to use we broadly, decided somehow that, you know, it was okay just to balloon up these huge deficits?
So a lot of it, well, war is never efficient, and wars cost a lot of money. And we were in the longest war that we ever were. I know that because I fought in it. So that's one. Two, part of the problem is we were sold a bum bill of goods. There's this story that we were told that, well, contractors can do things cheaper. All right. So everything started getting contracted out. And you'll find contractors in government everywhere, even in inherently government functions. Right now, the United States Army cannot feed itself. They have to hire contractors to feed them. Down at Fort Belvoir, they don't have soldiers guarding their own posts. They have contract gate guards. This is ridiculous. People say, well, we don't have to worry about the retirement or anything else. Yes, you do. You're paying that overhead. You're not only you're paying into their 401k or whatever they've got, whatever benefits they've got, you're paying their boss's overhead. And so this idea of privatizing everything, that's one of the reasons why we have a crisis now with student loans, is because we've privatized student loans. And so the interest rates have gone way up. There are inherently government functions that need to be done by the government, and they can be done cheaper and more efficiently. We got sold this bill of goods around, well, actually it was in the early 2000s, that contractors can do it cheaper and better. No, they can't. So the government functions need to be done by the government, and private industry can do what private industry does, which is make a profit. But whenever you outsource something like prisons or, VA services or anything like that, you're going to jack up the price.
Okay.
And it's got to stop. So that's one of the things that we need to do, is make sure that the government is doing inherently government functions and leave private industry to be their
Yeah.
for profit.
Okay. Through with that, thank you for clarifying about that. With this, let's segue into what you were talking about, government functions. So the Biden administration proposed, I don't think it was approved, but correct me if I'm wrong, that new regulations that would effectively shut down all coal production in West Virginia. Do you agree with that? And of course, that's an important economic activity, although it has been declining. But here, should we have the EPA effectively shutting down coal production in West Virginia?
So first of all, I call this myth of coal. So first of all, you can't completely shut down coal production. Coal is needed for other things other than just burning and making energy. Coal is used in the manufacturing of steel. Okay, you need coal. So coal is never going to completely go away. This is something that I like to call the myth of coal. And I've really been looking at this for quite some time. And that is this: the percentage of jobs in West Virginia that are related to coal is about 7%. The number one employer in the, so there's a top list of the top 100 employers in West Virginia. The number one employer in West Virginia is West Virginia University of Medicine.
That's what I thought. I was going to say WVU Health.
All right, do you know who the number two is?
After WVU Health. Oh boy. Valley Health. No, I don't, that's not as big. Number two employer. No, go ahead.
Every community has one.
Oh, the government, local governments.
No, Walmart.
Walmart.
Walmart. All right. Walmart contributes far more to our economy in West Virginia than any coal mine or mine owner. All right. We need to stop making policies over coal. I get it. Coal built this country. Coal won two world wars for us. And oh my God, the coal miners, incredible human beings. And I get it. And this is an emotional topic because people's grandparents were in the mines, people's dad were in the mines, and they suffered horribly. But we need to get realistic here and stop making policy over something. By the way, the Democrats didn't kill coal. The liberals didn't kill coal. The tree huggers and the EPA didn't kill coal. What killed coal was the petroleum industry. It's cheaper and more efficient to pump energy out of the ground than to dig it out of the ground. That's why coal is dying.
But what
And
about
so,
the, you didn't answer about the regulations from Biden? There were, I did see
I,
that.
I'm not gonna comment on it because I haven't read the regulations. I don't know what it is. But the point is there are coal power plants that are being converted into green energy. There was a big coal-fired plant actually up in Minnesota that has been converted over to green energy. There are other bridge, I call them bridge solutions. There's a big hydrogen station that's being built in West Virginia right now. I call those bridge because those are a bridge to the future for us. What we really need to do is basically nuclear fusion, not fission. Mm-hmm. Fission is what we currently think of, but nuclear fusion. It's obtainable in our lifetimes, and we need to treat this like the moonshot of the 60s. And once we harness literally the power of the sun in nuclear fusion, it's going to change the world.
And yeah, I agree. That would be fantastic. The current nuclear technology, I believe, correct me if I'm wrong, no nuclear plant has been built in like 40 years.
Yeah.
What do you think about this? It seems like I would say it's an excessive emphasis of the, especially I do have to say that is more a Democratic thing, the Biden and others, of the electric vehicles, even saying that in 15 years, 2035, less than that, you know, is it that close? Yeah, pretty soon, you know, you can't buy a gas car or something. Is that the right path, or should it be more gradual, or what?
Well, I mean, people should be able to choose what they want to drive, and they also should be penalized for it. Do you know right now that in West Virginia, if you have a hybrid or an electric vehicle, you have to pay more in registration for it?
Yes, a neighbor told me that I had to pay X many, 200 more or something to register.
Yeah, that's wrong. It's absolutely wrong, and that tells you that the lobbyists are deeply ingrained with the legislation here in West Virginia. Here's the deal. You should be able to choose, but getting off of fossil fuels is a good thing. Right now, the U.S. is producing more, you know, we're pumping more oil than we ever have been before under the Biden administration, if you want to make this partisan, but we are doing that. But it is not sustainable on a whole lot of levels. And oh, by the way, all these problems in the Middle East, okay, had they not had so much money injected into them, all right, would not have occurred. So, you know, getting off of petroleum it's a good thing. And, you know, I've got grandchildren, and, you know, what kind of planet do we want to leave for them? So, you know, as far as mandating, well, you know, unless we get pushed a little bit, we're not going to do anything about it. Now, the other thing, too, is a whole lot of mixed messages. Okay, so the government says, well, we need to lower emissions, yet we keep, as a government, subsidizing big oil. What's up with that? You know,
We've already got one of the lowest emissions of any country. So, I mean, as far as overall. But let's segue to another issue, if it's okay.
Okay, sure.
Yeah, I want to, you know, I work in the youth education field. So I have been positing and talking a lot of candidates that, you know, the decline of two-parent married families, specifically a male-female family, and the fact that like almost or around 50% of all children in West Virginia are now born outside of marriage, that has a radical effect on all areas of society. And to me, that is really the biggest problem, because that drives everything else, whether it be education outcomes, discipline in school, you know, crime, worker readiness, civic virtue, whatever. Would you agree with that? And then that would segue, I guess, into also, I'm wondering why there isn't more focus on like this kind of like education for youth versus debating too much about abortion. And also, what's your position about, you know, like so-called reproductive rights and all that?
Okay, you just asked me a whole lot of questions.
Yeah, well, first was about agreeing about the two-parent family, that since it's, you know, so fractured now, is that really the driver?
Well, what's most important is that every child needs at least one loving and caring parent. And I'm not going to define what a family is. A family is, you know, children being raised in a healthy and happy household, whether that's being done with one parent or two parent, or, you know, and their gender doesn't matter as long as they're being raised, you know, in that loving and supporting family. Now, a couple other things. Education. You talked about education. Yes, education is absolutely key. And West Virginia public education is absolutely under assault right now. There's something called the Hope Scholarship. Mm-hmm. The Hope Scholarship neither provides hope, nor is it a scholarship. It is a voucher program. Right. And it is taking money out of the West Virginia public schools, which are already some of the least funded in the entire United States. West Virginia teacher pay is 51st in the nation. I guess they threw DC in there for good measure.
Well, actually, I just look into that because I'm working on our local excess levy, which is like 40% of our taxes. Actually, West Virginia spends $15,360 per student. That would include federal, local property tax, state. And actually, it's not one of the lowest. We spend actually more than Virginia.
I was talking about teacher pay.
Okay, go ahead on that.
Teacher pay is the lowest in the country. All right. As far as expenditure per student, so I can tell you over 2,000 per student comes from the U.S. Department of Education.
Right.
And my opponent, Riley Moore, has promised, because he is a Project 2025 guy, to disestablish the U.S. Department of Education if he gets elected. So who's going to make up that difference of the over $2,000 per student? Mm-hmm. Okay, that's going to fall back on the state. And like I said, we're already have the lowest teacher pay. So if we're spending so much on our students, why is our outcome so poor?
Good question.
That is a really good question.
What do you think?
Well, obviously, where is the money actually going to? And is it making it to the local schools, or is it being funneled out to charter schools and everything else?
I think that's a false concept. Well, the Hope Scholarship doesn't take away from, they still get so much per student for each school. But one thing about I'm studying locally, trying to understand where our 40% of our property tax here in Jefferson County levy goes, and it's very non-transparent.
So,
and a lot of it goes, and I'm still working on it, but there's a new report required under state law that just was supposed, I don't think I got it, I requested, was supposed to come out September 30th, where you can get the pay of every person in your, just in your local school. And what I'm trying to get to is that a lot of it goes for the administrative central office. And that might explain why the teachers aren't getting much pay.
That could be. The other thing, though, too, is remember, Jefferson County is an outlier in the state. Everyone else in the state, we're losing population. Jefferson County is exploding. You guys are building great guns up there with things like Ryan Holmes and things like that. And Jefferson County has some very unique challenges ahead of it because of that growth. So I can't compare Jefferson County really with the rest of the district, because it is comparing.
Yeah, Apple. I'm talking about waste as far as school funding, but go ahead.
But that's what I'm saying is I haven't looked specifically at the health of Jefferson County's school districts and how you all are doing. But I will tell you, the Hope Scholarship does take money away from our public schools. Now, there will some people say, well, the money should follow the kid. Well, okay, that's fine. But that means that the money is also going out of state, especially in Jefferson County, because it can go up to Maryland. It can go down into Virginia, into charter schools.
That's true.
There are no guardrails on that program.
Yeah. But as far as the money, like, so if, you know, your child or my child was going to the local school, then the school, correct me if I'm wrong, will get an allocation for that child. If the child leaves the local school, they'll get a much smaller allocation for the Hope Scholarship. So you could argue it's saving money because if a child goes for Hope Scholarship, they're right now getting about $5,000, whereas the school, the state, including the federal, but mostly state, if you take out the $2,000 or whatever federal, the state's still spending $13,000 per student, local and statewide.
Let's agree to disagree on the Hope Scholarship. Again, I'm not, okay. You know, my opponent is a huge champion of it. Also, his children don't attend West Virginia public schools.
What about the broader issue of, well, you did mention already, I guess, the family. So you're disagreeing with my premise like that, that two parent married families would, if that could be strengthened, that would help?
Ideally, two parents is ideal. But you know what? That doesn't mean that a single parent can't raise a child in a loving and healthy situation.
No one was against single parents. So, we're just thinking.
And also, you did ask me about choice, too.
That's right. What about reproductive health or choice?
So the one thing I hear consistently from everyone I speak to in West Virginia is they want government out of their business. I can't think of anything more intrusive than government coming into basically your doctor's office and telling you what you can and cannot do. So are Mountaineers always free? Really? Well, right now, I don't think they are, because Mountaineers should be free to choose when and how to start a family. There's also a ballot initiative on the ballot right now. I just saw about assisted suicide.
Yeah.
Why are we legislating for things that have nothing to do with governance? All right. Knock it off.
Okay.
Am I clear on that one?
I got you on that. All right. So obviously you don't agree with the West Virginia's ban on abortion. So I wanted to ask you about one other thing that's related about choice and freedom. And that's what's sometimes called vaccination choice or medical freedom. I've been very much working on that issue since I've been over here in West Virginia for 8 years. I used to live, believe it or not, in D.C., other places too. But anyway, point being, I was kind of shocked in a way to find out that in that thing, West Virginia is less free than Washington, D.C., because if I want to send my kids to the school in West Virginia, and it's still true because of all schools, public pride, because governor vetoed that, Governor Justice, which I strongly disagree with, that you, the parent, can decide if your child should be vaccinated, not West Virginia. What's your take on that?
All right. First of all, the whole anti-vaxxer thing, you know, this all got started over some junk science a couple of decades ago, and it's done. You know, people don't realize how horrible polio, measles, diphtheria, and all these things that used to kill, absolutely kill. And now we act like, well, it's an option. You know what? If you're going to be part of a society, you need to play by the rules of society. And part of it is protecting the collective alone. All right. So when I went off to boot camp, I don't know how many immunizations I had, maybe 9, 10 of them. All right.
Immunizations. 44 states allow exemptions, though. Why should we?
All right. So
medical or other religious.
If there is a medical reason not to immunize, then don't immunize. As far as religions go, you know, unless you are a one of the recognized religions that really has a problem with medical intervention, then okay, fine. But I will tell you, the vast majority, they're basing this information on some junk science that has been disproved over and over again. And oh, by the way, this caused a readiness issue in the United States Navy that I lived through. All right. I was a department head, all right, at a major command in the DC area, and we had issues during COVID. And quite frankly, we were having a hard time meeting mission until the vaccine allowed us all to come back to work and come back up to full strength. So I will tell you, you know,
wasn't the issue that a lot of people were forced to take the vaccine, and I'm talking about military now, and then they were whatever it was, discharged.
Well, if they were forced to take the vaccine, then they weren't.
They didn't, so they were discharged.
Yes,
causing a shortage of staff.
No, that's a misnomer. Very few people actually got discharged because of it. And like I said, this was handled incredibly poorly, and quite frankly, caused some serious issues with discipline in the ranks. So when you sign up for the military, all right, you are signing away some things. One of the things that I signed away for 39 years was some of my First Amendment rights. All right. And you do not have necessarily bodily autonomy. And this is a voluntary service. All right. So when you put your name on the dotted line, okay, you're agreeing to forego some of these rights. So, you know, I don't have a whole lot of sympathy for folks when it comes to stuff like this.
Okay.
By the way, you know, the anthrax vaccine was also kind of jammed down on us and found to be, you know, not particularly necessary. But you know what? I'm still here. All right. I'm fully vaccinated, and thank God for it, because, you know, as an older person, I do have, I'm just going to say it. I have sleep apnea. And you know what? If I contracted COVID, I probably wouldn't have survived. So thank God for the vaccine.
All right. So I guess I assume you wouldn't be in favor of repealing the 1986 Act. I forget the exact technical name that removes liability from pharmaceutical companies for vaccination. It's called the National Childhood, I think, Vaccination Act, NVIC.
I am never in favor of letting someone off the hook for negligence or malfeasance.
But that has let pharma pretty much off the hook.
Well, that's something I would look at, because you know what? If you're negligence, or you cut corners, or you do something wrong that harms somebody, you should be held accountable.
Okay. All right. Well, thanks for that answer. So that's clear. So just to give a chance, since we're coming toward the time limit, just anything else you'd like to talk about or differentiate yourself from Riley Moore, or just say why voters should vote for you, or anything else you'd like to talk about or conclude with?
Thank you, Richard. So first off, I don't call it our biggest problem. I call it the first problem, and that is campaign financing. There is way too much money in politics. And right now, people have written off this race and that race because they haven't raised X amount of money. That's not okay. And that's not democracy. Riley Moore has raised over $1 million. I've raised a little shy of $30,000. That's not because I'm not a great fundraiser. It's because that's what I chose to do. I do not take money from special interests or from PACs. People, please go out to fec.gov and look at your candidate, and look at, one, where their money is coming from, and two, how they spend their money. All right. Riley Moore has taken an inordinate amount of money from people like Charles Koch. He's taken it from energy companies like First Energy. He's taken it from petroleum companies. Oh, by the way, his whole ESG thing, all right, and blacklisting banks, that was for oil companies to do that. And it's not right. I'm not for sale, all right? I want to work for one group of people, and that's the people of West Virginia. And so I will never take PAC money. I will never take special interest money. And I will vote for our interests, not for the interests of a corporation or a special interest or someone else like that. And so until we can get money out of the system, by the way, that's my first thing I want to do, is I want to see how can we limit campaign spending. All right. Citizens United was a horrible Supreme Court decision. And even if it takes a constitutional amendment to change that, but corporations should not have the same rights as individuals. So please, I implore everyone, please look at who's financing your candidate, because it will tell you a whole lot about what they will really do once they're elected.
Okay, that's a fair statement. Well, I want to thank you for your time today. We had a good discussion, a little sometimes lively, but that's good.
Oh, it's wonderful. You
know, yeah.
Hey, conversations are where it's at. And here's the thing, you know, and we can still be friends at the end of it. You know,
there
we
you
don't
go.
Have to agree on everything. All right. But we can all agree that, you know, we're Americans and we want what's best for this country. And having a conversation is where it starts.
That's great. Okay, so I'm going to make this available by podcast and on video, and I hope it helps voters to decide who to vote for
on
November 5th.
I hope so.
Yeah, so thank you very much again for joining us today.
Thank you, Richard. And again, it's Stephen Wendelin, running for the 2nd Congressional District of West Virginia. My website is www.wendelinforcongress.com. If you can't remember how to spell my name, there's a back way kind of into the website. That Sailor, all one word, thatsailor.com will get you to my website.
All right. Great. All right. Okay.
All right. Thank you, sir.
Thank you. All right. Bye-bye.